are listening to Red Ice Radio with headquarters in Sweden, Northern Europe, and North America. I'm Henrik, your host, and we are glad to have you with us today. Thank you for connecting with us. Well, check out our website, redicecreations.com and redicesradio.net for more news, videos, and of course, radio on all the topics that we consider to be absolutely vital to be informed about in preparation for what's coming and for action as well. I mean, we need to continue to lay down facts, but also show the agenda of the establishment and outline the ideological groundwork for newcomers and for people who are realizing and waking up to the threats that we are facing. We are pro-European, primordial traditionalists for the European people and our culture. Some use the term alt-right, others don't. That's fine. I don't care what you call it or getting lost in denominations or nomenclature. There's no time or energy or resources to spend on infighting and petty factionalized groupings at this time. What we face is far worse than those who, for the most part, stand on your page as well. And those who continue to press on those issues and continue to focus on all the disagreements, pouring salt in the eyes of your brothers and sisters, rather than focusing on how much we actually have in common, is going the wrong way, if you ask me. And then it seems to me that you're more interested in fighting over surrounding issues than over the main issue at hand. So shape up and realize that we have bigger fish to fry and try to realize what is at stake here as well. This is an appeal for standing together, not breaking apart. And furthermore, since when do you have to agree with everything to be able to cooperate with someone? I hope you can think about it at least and use your brain. Thanks. Well, today we have Matthew Heimbach and Jack Senn with us to discuss Matt's exclusion letter from the UK by special order from Home Secretary Theresa May. It's ironic and funny in a kind of morbid way because we recorded this interview earlier in the day on Friday the 13th when we had the terrorist attacks in Paris. And it demonstrates, I think, the utter insanity of European leaders that we have absolutely no idea whatsoever of who is coming into European countries, the UK and Scandinavia included. The borders are wide open to the rest of the world, and terrorists disguised as refugees with, skinny jeans, iPhones, and selfie sticks are coming into Europe, and they're allowed doing so, despite the warnings that they themselves, that Islamic State, issued earlier in the year. It seems to indicate that what happened in Paris is an okay side effect of mass migration. But haters like Matthew Heimbach, nothing could be more important to Theresa May to spend special time on this by personally writing and tracking down Matt to send him this letter telling him that he's barred from entering the UK. And this is someone who's actually advocating for the interests of the European people. Does she send known terrorists these kinds of letters too? Not that I've heard of. Well, that right there, folks, should tell you everything you need to know about how upside down our world is today. More coming up. Stay tuned. All right, we have Matt Heimbach back with us, and also, of course, Jack Senn. Both has been on the show previously on separate occasions. Thank you to both of you for coming on. It's great to speak with you lads again. How are you doing?
Doing good. It's always good to be back, and I wanted to thank also all your listeners for, after I was on Red Ice the last time, all the kind messages I got. So you guys are the best.
Thank you.
Thanks, Henrik. I really appreciate you having us back. A great radio program, the best on the net.
Well, thank you for that. Appreciate that. Now, we have, of course, kind of a recent incident that has occurred that we want to try to get a little bit closer to an understanding. I caught the story a bit late, actually. It kind of transpired by the time we're recording this earlier last week, and it's basically you, Matt, has been denied entry into the UK, and it all came together due to an event that you're hosting, Jack. Let's begin with you, Jack, and explain a bit what the event was and is. I know that you have a new, organization of sorts, an umbrella organization that you've started up. Is this the event that Matt was going to speak at?
Yeah, it was. It's the British Renaissance. I started up after I left the British National Party. I wanted to start an organization that unified different nationalists under one umbrella, and I wanted to make sure that we could monitor these different organizations to make sure they didn't go down the wrong route and turn into, kosher nationalist parties, basically. And so we started the event. Jez Turner and I were planning to do the event on the 29th of November. And then Matt and I got in communication regarding him being the keynote speaker. I was a big fan of his work over the United States. And then he and I got in contact.
Right. And, yeah, tell us what happened, Matt. How did this message arrive to you?
Well, it was really funny. I was actually out with my wife, and now we have a 3-month-old son, so we don't get out of the house very often. So we were going out for a family lunch at Cracker Barrel, which for any of the foreign listeners is a Southern style family restaurant. And I got a call from my mother, and she calls, and I answer it, and she goes, "You're banned from England." And I thought, "No, what are you talking about?" And she goes, "I just got a letter from the British government that said that you're banned from England." And I was like, "Mom, you're crazy. It must be a joke. Send it to me and I'll see." And then I got back to my house, because I haven't lived, at my parents' house for many years. And in my mailbox at home was, lo and behold, a letter from the UK Home Secretary informing me that I was persona non grata in the United Kingdom for all my comments that I've made throughout the years. And it was really funny. They actually listed like a page and a half of quotes of mine. So over the span of multiple years of my work, so someone had to sit and read like dozens of articles and listen to hours of speeches and podcasts to assemble this Frankenstein creation list. So someone was really dedicated into finding all the things they could possibly think of to get me banned from the UK. So after I got that letter, obviously I touched base with Jack, and I officially now am a thought criminal on Airstrip 1, from as George Orwell would say.
Well, there you go. That's a good addition to have, of course.
Yeah.
But how did they? I mean, so you're telling me they went to the trouble, though, of locating you, finding out where you lived, designing, I guess, a tailored letter to you, correct?
Yeah, it was it was a little bizarre and unnerving, actually, to think that they had both they went after my parents, but also myself. And I've actually got the letter in front of me, and it's kind of an interesting thing that it wasn't just about, they claimed racism, anti-Semitism, all the buzzwords, but they also mentioned that in 2015, you, me obviously, stated your opposition to homosexuality and funding of LGBT events by posting an online article titled "Traditionalist Youth Network to Demand No Gay Pride in the Bible Belt." And it goes on to quote from the article, in which I say that there is a homosexual agenda to attack the sanctity of Christian churches by promoting homosexual marriage and to influence young people with a deviant lifestyle that must be opposed by all honorable means. So, in the own quote that was supposedly so damning against me, I simply said that there is obviously an agenda to use the state and the media to coerce Christian church to abide by the rules of the far left, and that young people are being brought into this lifestyle, and we should oppose it by all honorable means, which means I'm not advocating violence, I'm not advocating hate crimes or anything like that. We went with several church groups and our group to go and hold a protest at a gay pride rally that was being using taxpayer dollars for, but it was peaceful. There were no arrests, no problems. So apparently the example that's being presented, in this letter is my ideas are the danger, because I've never been arrested, I've never committed a criminal act, and there's really no reason for them to ban me other than my ideas. But on the flip side, of course, the men that murdered Lee Rigby, of course,
right, yep,
were brought into England, and they were radicalized. They were listening to radical Islamic preachers. They became jihadists. They murdered someone. They had clear connections to terrorism. They were allowed in the UK, but believing that Christian churches shouldn't be forced against their own teachings to say homosexual marriages within their church is apparently too radical for the Home Secretary.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, this becomes so absurd when we put this in the context of other things that especially has been going on in England and the radical Islam that is thriving in London at this time. Let's talk a little bit more about that later. But Jack, let's go back to you for a second. Was any of this then, do you think, initiated by the fact that they knew that you were going to host an event, or why did they get their eyes on Matt at this time to say you can't come into England?
Yeah, I think so. That comes into play, certainly. What transpired was, I actually had the idea when I was in the British National Party to host an event that bring people to the BNP. The BNP were all for the event until they realized that I was going to have some speakers that they thought were a bit too extreme. They then tried to have me remove those speakers. I refused to stand down, and that created a bit of friction within the party. They asked me not to have Matthew or Jez at the event, and I said no, that they're going to speak at the event. And at that point then, there was a bit of friction within the party, and then Hope Not Hate, an anti-fascist organization, profiled me and the event, and they did a hatchet job on me and the event. It was quite peculiar, the timing. It was just like perfect timing for them to come up with this story. I then started getting contacted by a bunch of major newspapers, asking me about the event, if people could profile it. I said certainly they could. And then I was told by the BNP I was no longer wanted in the party. And then within a couple of days of that, Matthew rings me and says that he's got a letter from the Home Secretary. So the timing of everything and the sequence of events is quite disturbing. I don't know what to make of it. I still don't know what to make of it, to be honest with you. But here I am. I'm no longer in the BNP because I'm, quote, too extreme. Matthew's not allowed in the country because he's, quote, too extreme. All we wanted to do was have an event that would, you know, just elucidate the truth and spread some information to some different people. The event is actually quite a moderate event. We're going to have people from the BNP, from the British Democrats, from the British Voice, from UKIP, from several church groups coming to the event. It's going to be a nice lunch at a nice hotel. But for some reason, no one wanted this event to take place. We're still going through with it, of course. It might be slightly different than we intended. But at the end of the day, I really do think that they're scared of this message. They're scared of grassroots organizations coming together to discuss root causes. They don't mind us going on the streets, shaving our heads, shouting death to Islam or death to Britain if we're on the other side. But when we start talking about root causes and people that are behind the problems, that's when they start to freak out.
Yeah.
Well, Jack, that's another interesting thing, how I think I kind of fit into this greater context. Because here in America, you know, we have now unveiled the Traditionalist Worker Party, which is going to work in concert with a large number of identitarian groups, pro-white groups, traditionalist groups, to be able to run candidates on the local and state level. And actually, we've assembled on our board of directors representatives from half a dozen different organizations. So we're actually trying to have the same sort of thing that Jack is doing in England, of a coalition group to be able to have nationalists come together to work on strategy, to be better organized, and to really engage the cultural Marxists on the streets. So it seems to me that I think Jack's really onto something as to why this was such a big threat and to why myself. I don't think I'm that dangerous. I don't think I'm that important to have all this attention of the Home Secretary. But I think they're scared of the deeper idea that nationalists putting aside beefs, because when nationalists are fighting each other, which, you know, the movement half the time is a circular firing squad, at least in the United States. You know, when we can start crossing group boundaries in our own countries and are crossing international boundaries to realize that nationalists all have common interests, we all have common goals, and we can help one another in presentation and strategy and tactics, all these different things, that's a real threat to the status quo. So I think the idea that we're actually being professional, we're working together, and we're really trying to make gains and get normal people on our side, not just being stuck on the fringes of politics, is a real danger to the system, which is why we've gotten so much attention.
Right. Well, exactly. I've noticed, too, that it's as soon as you kind of do something out on the ground, out on physical, not just behind your screen or hiding behind your avatar, obviously you do get targeted quite quickly. Lana and I went to the NPI conference, and surely soon enough we're on the SPLC website. We haven't been there before. So it seems that as soon as you begin to kind of, reach out, meet people, do something in real life, that's really when it begins to get, in their view, dangerous, and something has to be done about you, right?
I agree. And I think another thing that they're worried about, and this might sound simplistic, but once you put a suit and a tie on and you're a nationalist, you become a threat. You're not a threat when you have tattoos and, no offense, I have a tattoo myself, so it's not about tattoos. But when you come across as a thug or you come across as though you're some kind of hoodlum or hooligan, you become a caricature of, typical, quote, neo-Nazi. And you're not a threat to the establishment because no normal citizen who's respectful, who cares about the society would support you. But when you wear a suit and a tie, you have, you speak eloquently, you're a decent, upstanding citizen. That's when they get scared. I mean, give an example of Jez Turner. He gave a speech outside downtown Downing Street. And he was right away, you know, they were shouting at him, kill him, arrest him. Mm. And within a few months, he received a letter from the police asking him to come to Scotland Yard, which he did with his solicitor. And all because of the fact that he came across as an upstanding gentleman wearing a suit, speaking the truth. And they're scared of that. If you go down there looking like a fool, it plays into their interests. But if you go down and you look like a respectable citizen who's voicing valid concerns, and these are concerns that they do not want you to have to talk, that you to talk about, they start getting really scared. And I think that's what it comes down to. And I think Matthew and I, we don't come across like standard, quote, nationalist thugs. And I think that they were more scared of that as well. The fact that we're not the, you know, the typical, you know, burn them alive type that walks on the street with a flag and shouting. You know, we do this the smart way on the internet, writing articles, grassroots organization of people, reaching out to representatives from new parties. And it's really pretty damn scary for them.
Yeah, I wanted to put this in the context of what's happening in the UK right now, because, I mean, Matt, obviously things are a bit better for now in the US, right? You still have the First Amendment. There are definitely other things that occur to you if you begin to speaking out, such as losing your job, getting ostracized on the social level, all these kinds of problems. They still write about you in the media, etc. But in England now, Jack, it definitely is a bit, I mean, they're starting to clamp down. I'm referring to this specifically, the Home Secretary, Theresa May. I think it was earlier this year. She did a radio show interview. You might be able to listen to it here later. I'm just going to pull it up. About her talking about, you know, what they want to seek to have done in England right now. And it's quite extraordinary. I mean, it's really turning into, it's kind of a cliche of saying it, but it's really turning into that Orwellian kind of, you know, Brave New World type of reality over in England, where they literally are going after thought criminals, those who have the wrong opinions. And that First Amendment that exists in America doesn't really exist within the UK environment, correct?
No, correct. In the United Kingdom, it's quite frightening. I mean, there's a kid named Josh Bonehill who is sitting in prison for, I think, drawing a cartoon. There's countless examples of people who've literally just like you said, violated some sort of thought law and landed up in prison. I mean, it's quite a scary situation. And, you know, I've joked often to my wife that I'm waiting for the day that the door knocks and I've got six policemen at the front door. We already had an instance where the cops surrounded our house. They came in and they asked me a series of questions a few months ago. They dressed it up as they were just investigating some issues with my candidacy. There were some threats made against me. But at the end of the day, when I spoke with the police, I recognized early on that I was the one they were investigating. And I was a candidate for Parliament. So you can imagine what would transpire if you're not a political candidate and you're just a organizer. What they could do to you. I mean, they could literally stick you in prison for speaking your mind if they don't agree with what you're saying. And I think that it's under David Cameron, Britain's become a lot more Orwellian because of the fact that Cameron, like Nigel Farage, is a Zionist, unlike the Jewish Ed Miliband, who was actually slightly less of a Zionist. So in some ways, I think it's worse under the Tory government or even under a UKIP government than it would have been under a Lib Dem or a Labour government.
Really?
Because, certainly, because you know, if you look at the election, Ed Miliband lost support of the Jewish vote, even though he's himself Jewish. The majority of the Jewish vote went to UKIP and the Tory party.
Right.
So I think, you know, Ed Miliband being Jewish was not enough to save him in the eyes of the Jewish community. The fact that he was slightly balanced when it came to Israel was enough for them to say, you know what, we'll support, you know, toffee-nosed Tory or, you know, pubs beer-drinking Nigel Farage because they're far more pro-Israel and pro-Zionist. So I think that they'll go with any party that will silence free speech, that will infringe upon the rights of people. They're not about freedom of speech. They're just about protecting their own interests.
Well, of course, and I think, Matt, I mean, you posted the letter on Twitter, and I think it was reposted by this one British group, CST. That's the one that that The Guardian picked up on, actually. What was that called? It was like the subline was protecting our Jewish community, I think, right?
Yeah, it's actually a group. I did an article on the Traditionalist Youth Network website about being a thought criminal, and I researched this group because they were bragging about how they were involved in getting me banned and petitioning the Home Secretary, and they're a Jewish group that actually does, I mean, kind of basically paramilitary training to be able to have self-defense forces for Jews to be able to safeguard Jews. and synagogues and things like that.
Yep.
So they're actually doing physical training, which involves like hand-to-hand combat training that's advertised on their website. So here you have, I mean, of course, we all know the double standard and the flip side. If a group of nationalists was doing physical training and doing paramilitary stuff
England
or in any country, it would be, you know, the federal government would be involved. You know, there'd be a RICO case. There'd be all sorts of stuff. But, of course, there is a double standard when it comes to enforcement of the law. So, yeah, this is a Jewish group that is explicitly working to battle anti-Semitism wherever they find it, and apparently I fell under their under the eye of Sorod. It came onto me, and they didn't like what I was saying. But you know, I think that's one of the interesting things. You know, we're talking about free speech. That America, I don't think, is that far behind England.
Right.
If you just look at what's happening at Mizzou right now, and at Yale, and at American universities all across this country right now, this idea of safe spaces, of restricting freedom of speech, freedom of the press, to be able to create safe spaces. You know, some of these black groups, like at Mizzou, who are forcing all non-blacks out of the out of their meetings to hold segregated meetings. That whites aren't allowed to have their opinions heard, and they're shouted down, or possibly even facing, the local police at Mizzou actually said, if you hear anything racist or anything that troubles you, to call the emergency hotline, and the police would get involved. So I actually think we're seeing in America, just over this past week, the idea that hate speech laws, I do not think, are that far behind. I think very soon nationalists in America are going to be dealing with the same situation that our comrades in Britain and the rest of Europe are dealing with.
Well, exactly. And I mean, a safe space basically means that there isn't any white people around, right? That's like they need to have it's funny because it's kind of reverting back again. We've had this the idea of white privilege and, of course, white supremacy, you know, within any white country. That's been a threat to them, but the previous attitude towards this was to become kind of, I guess, not notice these differences, become colorblind, not see any of this. What it's turned into now is some kind of hypersensitivity about these issues, that we as white people have to be, hypersensitive to any little nuance that any other small minority or ethnicity might have, so that when you encounter them, you know exactly what kind of speech protocol and behavioral pattern you're supposed to adopt to make them feel safe in the space when you're around them, right?
Well, it's funny. I actually had asked. I tweeted out at this movement the idea that if blacks are allowed to be able to have their safe spaces, that's great. But are whites allowed to have safe spaces? And I think we had a name for those a couple decades ago. They were called the suburbs.
I was just going to say they were called the suburbs. That's very funny. Yeah. You're right.
but yeah, I mean, it's given this bizarre view where there's almost a two-tier system where they're advocating on campus, and of course, a lot of these black students are being led by outside agitators. It was the same thing that's happened in American politics over the past several decades, going back to the civil rights movement, where you've got rich, influential, radical leftists who are pumping money and resources and training to be able to rile up different groups to pit them against each other. So this becomes a black versus white issue instead of realizing that the globalist policies are affecting every community. And that's something that they're very good at, it's kind of a divide and conquer process. But it's curious to me, the idea that it's getting to be explicitly anti-white hatred on American campuses, and even far left things like Salon have done articles from professors that are having to censor themselves. You know, colleges are supposed to be a place of freedom of speech. That's, you know, even in the 1960s, Commander George Lincoln Rockwell of the American Nazi Party was invited to speak at dozens of American universities, not by right-wing groups, but by free speech groups, to be able to have an active debate on American politics.
Yeah.
But that's not being allowed anymore
no.
at American universities. Professors are under speech codes just like students are now.
Yeah, and Matthew raised a good point about these certain group of people sowing the seeds of discord in society. And I read something Dr. Kevin McDonald wrote about the riots in Ferguson, Missouri, and it was a rabbi, Susan Talv, who was marching with the blacks. And again, I saw all these black people, and their organizers were not black. Some were white, some were Jewish, but they were all certainly using the blacks to further their really demented aims. And the same thing happens in the United Kingdom. Interesting story. A few years ago, I was involved with a guy that was heavily involved with the English Defense League. And he wasn't a very bright guy, but he was a genuine guy. And he would go down to the rallies with the EDL. And he said to me one time when he got back from a rally, I was on the bus, and there was an American guy on the bus. And I said, what do you mean by an American guy? He said, well, he was wearing a suit and a tie, and he was from Washington, D.C., and he was sitting at the front of the bus, and he was telling us what to say, how to say it, where to stand. And he said, well, I didn't realize there were Americans involved with the EDL. This is way before people, you know, Nick Griffin and different people have come out with the, these different studies that show the EDL is funded by think tanks in the United States connected to, you know, neoconservative groups. But these same people, whatever they may be, on the left, different groups, sometimes on the right, you know, they're just trying to stir up trouble in our societies, and they're trying to pit groups against each other. And it's going to result in a lot of bloodshed. And now, obviously, with the immigration crisis or the invasion crisis, it could result in, you know, whole-scale mass murder in the streets soon. I mean, look at the way things are going.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. That's right. I want to ask you guys both about that later. We want to put this in the context of what's happening with the invasion and Islam and Rotherham, you know, things like this. It's unbelievable that this is their concern, you know. But one thing I wanted to mention first before we move on here is that, you know, isn't it funny now how the, you know, the left, the cultural Marxism that has been victorious in the Western world have now really become the thugs, if you will, that they claim that their opposition once was, right? That they, the long-standing virtue of the left was that they represented free speech, no censorship, freedom of expression, all these kinds of things. But those that have advanced now in the culture wars have become the enforcers of these speech codes. I mean, why aren't they more open-minded and tolerant of the things they don't understand and fear, right?
Well, it's the sort of thing, if you just look at the, you know, especially campus politics. I mean, the homosexual movement is just one example, you know, and in the 1970s, they were saying, you know, at the Stonewall riots, hey, we just want to be left alone, you know, just accept us, you know, and then they wanted additional rights, and then they wanted gay marriage, and then within a couple months of wanting gay marriage, Christian businesses are being sued out of existence, and Christian pastors are facing things like jail time for speaking out against these issues. You know, in England, a pastor for actually just reading a passage from the Bible was arrested and faced charges of, I believe it was incitement against minorities because he read a quote from Leviticus. So, no, it's totally flipped when it comes to our policies because the left is disingenuous. And this is one thing, the difference between the left and nationalists, besides ideology, is when we tell people who we are and what we want, we're telling the truth. But the left is always thinking about how to work to subvert the institutions and the culture, because that's their nature. They're internationalists by design. You know, that's why the banner of the left for decades was singing the Internationale. And that's, I think, the big difference. Everything they work towards is based on subversion, is based on consolidating power, and then taking that power, crushing traditionalists and nationalists, and then uniting with other globalist elements around the world, where you know, as nationalists, we view as communities, ethnicities, cultures, that we should be able to basically chart our own course. But the left always, no matter what country it's in, wants to push ahead for this international vision, where eventually they will be at the top of the pyramid, keeping us all under their boot here.
Yeah, I wonder what kind of world they're creating, though, with all this conflict and religious and cultural ethnic strife and everything else. It's not a pretty picture, you know, because, let's get to that later. Let's play this clip first of Theresa May, and we'll see what she says. She's talking with another radio host here, so here we go.
First of all, I mean, the reason for doing this, John, I mean, you talk about tolerance and intolerance. I mean, there are people out there, sadly, who are seeking to divide us. We are a government's one nation.
Yeah.
We want to bring people together to ensure we are living together as one society. But there are those who are trying to promote hatred and intolerance, seeking to divide us into a them and us and undermine our British values. And what we are proposing is a bill which will have certain measures within it, measures such as introducing banning orders for groups and disruption orders for individuals, for those who are out there actively trying to promote this hatred and intolerance, which can lead to division in our society and undermines our British values. But it will be part of a bigger picture, a strategy which will also have as a key part of it actually promoting our British values, our values of democracy, rule of law, tolerance and understanding, you know, acceptance of different faiths.
And freedom of speech, an essential prerequisite of a tolerant and decent society. And if you ban groups of people from getting together and talking about the things that worry them about the way our society is heading, don't you become a part of it?
No, well, first of all, I would say that your description of what you're chosen to do is not right.
Well, you're talking about banning groups of certain groups of people getting together.
We're not talking about banning groups of people getting together who are simply talking about problems in society or what they perceive as issues that need to be addressed.
So when do they step over the edge?
We are talking about the extremism of all sorts, Islamist extremism, but also other forms of extremism like neo-Nazism, that is seeking to promote hatred, that is seeking to divide our society, that is seeking to undermine the very values that make us a great country to live in, that make us this great pluralistic society.
And how do you divide a society then? Let's assume, for instance, that a group of people put together a meeting at which they expressed views about homosexuality that you or I might perhaps find repugnant. Would they be dividing society?
What we're talking about here is an extremism that is that has an impact, that is divisive, that is trying to undermine our values.
Well, that would be divisive, wouldn't it?
That is trying to undermine our values. But the reason that we're doing this is, first of all, because we do need, I think, to ensure that we are together as one society. We are one nation. We are working
speaking
to ensure
with one
that
voice.
There will be different views within that nation. Of course there will be different views. Nobody is suggesting that different views cannot be expressed.
Oh, man.
But one of the reasons for looking at this issue of extremism is the path down which it can lead people. And what we can see often is that this extremist preaching, this message of hatred, this message of intolerance, can actually lead down a path of radicalization.
And what I'm trying to get you to define is at what point it strays into that area, at what point it doesn't become just a disagreement with you or me or the bloke next door or the woman next door, it becomes something that should worry us to the extent that it should be banned. That's what I'm trying to get at. At what point does it qualify for being banned?
And obviously when we introduce the legislation which has these banning orders, one of the tasks in that legislation will be to ensure that we have the definitions.
You don't have it.
So that they can, well, we have a definition of extremism, which we have in our extremism strategy.
But you seem to be saying you'll know it when you see it, which is a bit unsatisfactory.
I'm not saying we know it when we see it. John, the whole process of introducing legislation in this country is that actually you start off with the principle of what we want to do, which is to ensure that we can promote British values, the values that unite us.
Isn't it promoting British values? You can't have legislation to promote British values, can you? A law that says these are our values and if you don't agree with them, then, well, what? You go to jail? I mean, how do you promote British values in a legalistic sense?
I suspect that there are many people listening to this programme who feel that actually we haven't, as a society in the past, been positive enough about the values that unite us as a society.
What does that mean? Forgive me for using the phrase again, but that's a bit woolly, isn't it? Positive enough. I mean, I could run out into the street now, and you couldn't say, look, these are the values we all stand for, wonderful, wonderful. Somebody else would come along and say, rubbish, I believe in something different. Now, at what point, what I'm really puzzled by is how you get to define the line, you draw the line at which you've crossed over that line and it's unacceptable, legally unacceptable.
Well, that is, if I may, the one part of what we're doing is the legislation, which has the banning orders, the disruption orders, the ability to close premises. And that will have very clearly within it, will have definitions of extremism. We've set out a definition of extremism at the moment, but we'll very clearly set out in the legislation how those banning orders will operate.
So what is extremism? Because we have loads of laws that ban, for instance, hate speech, all sorts of laws. You obviously can't incite violence. That is a criminal offence. You go to jail for it. What is it that we are trying to ban?
Well, we are trying to deal with those situations, with those in our society who are actively operating or promoting an extremism, which is undermining. I know you say that promoting our values is something that you say is woolly, but actually,
it is woolly because it could mean anything, couldn't it? I mean, depending on who you are. If, for instance, you believe in gay marriage, fine, that is a value for you. If you don't believe in gay marriage, you're absolutely entitled not to believe in gay marriage, and presumably you would still be entitled to say, I don't believe in gay marriage. I think it damages society.
Yes, but
that would offend your values.
But what we're talking about is the key values that underline our society and are being undermined by the extremists. Values like democracy, a belief in democracy, a belief in the rule of law, a belief in tolerance for other people, equality, an acceptance of other people's faith and religions. We all have.
Oh, listen to that. I got to pause there. Listen to
that's
that.
That's too, much.
Oh, yeah. My God. I mean, it just goes and goes. But what we're talking about is the key values that underline our society and that are being undermined by the extremists. Values like democracy, a belief in democracy, a belief in the rule of law, as she goes on to say, a belief in tolerance for other people, equality and acceptance for other people's faith and religions. I mean, she doesn't understand what she's saying here, probably, or something, you know?
To get a little perspective here, Theresa May, after the Charlie Hebdo incident, she came out with a, you know, Je suis Charlie, and she said something along the lines of, without Jews, Britain would not be Britain, blaming, obviously, the incident on anti-Semitism. Yet, the people that, in Charlie Hebdo, were deliberately trying to incite violence between Gentiles on the streets, Muslims, and the indigenous population, those are the people that she should be looking at. I wouldn't say censoring, but those are the people who are deliberately inciting violence and hatred. I mean, Charlie Hebdo, for example, they never had anything critical of Jews. The only time Charlie Hebdo ever even insinuated anything negative about Jews was an instance where they drew a cartoon when Nicolas Sarkozy's son, I think, converted to Judaism. I mean, already Jewish to begin with, but he somehow converted or refound his Jewish roots when he married into a Jewish family. Charlie Hebdo created a cartoon poking fun at that. The guy who drew that cartoon was fired from Charlie Hebdo. When that's not even remotely close to some of the other cartoons that Charlie Hebdo had, where they would have Jesus Christ being raped by God, and they'd have Muhammad having, you know, sexual relations with children or whatever they had on their covers. I mean, those are deliberately inciting hatred in the society between groups that probably shouldn't even be in conflict with each other on our soil, because, right. I mean, Muslims are coming in the wrong way to begin with. But what they are is a group of people who are inciting violence, and she defended these people, but now she wants to censor what I'm saying and block what Matt's saying because she doesn't like it.
Yeah.
But yet the people that deliberately incited violence and it resulted in bloodshed, she defended. It makes no sense.
I mean, when she keeps talking about equality and acceptance, Zach, why are your opinions then not accepted? What is it she doesn't understand? And the second thing to this is she's talking about, you know, unified Britain, unified values. I mean, do these people really believe that they can take people from, you know, the West Indies, Caribbeans, Muslims, homosexuals, socialist, anarchists, capitalists, industrialists, royalists, and nationalists, and just jam these together into one nation, and they should all sit there and have some kind of shared value system? I mean, it's they're delusional. It's just never going to work.
Well, and it's the sort of thing that I think is really interesting. In Sweden, they had a gay pride march that was organized by, I think, a group of nationalists.
Yeah, he's kind of
a majority Muslim neighborhood.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, Matt, but he's kind of a cuck conservative. I know the guy who did it. He was kind of racking on me and what we did with Red Eyes, I know, because of the fact that we talk about the JQ and all that stuff. So he's kind of, he's trying to create this kind of, only showing how bad the Muslims are, you know. I mean, he's doing something, I guess. I mean, and I credit him for that, but he's using one, the weakness, if you will, of one group or the victimhood of one group to try to target another. So he's, you know, he's kind of trying to be clever in that way. But yeah, go ahead, Matt.
But, you know, the idea of having a gay pride parade go through a Muslim neighborhood, and, you know, of course you've got Muslim youths who are throwing rocks and, you know, using homophobic, language, and all these sorts of things that, of course, again, if nationalists were to do that at a gay pride rally, we would be prosecuted to the full extent of the law. But there is absolutely no way the left's vision can come to fruition, because, you know, in England, for instance, you've got, you know, hate preachers like Anjam Chowdhury that are marching down the street saying, UK go to hell, UK police go to hell, you know, there will be no democracy, Sharia law will dominate, we will be part of a global caliphate. Like, right there, you have got Islamic hate preachers who are actively supporting overthrowing the system of the United Kingdom. But they're allowed to do whatever they want. They get on TV when they want. They can hold meetings when they want. They can hold marches when they want. But nationalists aren't allowed to do that. So that tells us that the system isn't actually, it doesn't actually believe its own rhetoric. It's not using its own supply, you know. It's what they really believe in is using all of this rhetoric, just like how originally these immigrants coming in, well, they were temporary guest workers. So, well, then we're going to be able to go ahead and do this multiracial experiment, and now they're refugees. They change the language depending on, you know, whatever the circumstances are. It's kind of like trying to grab at a cloud. You know, it just kind of goes through your hands because they're not actually based on any convictions. They don't stand on a foundation. All they want to do is, at the end of the day, subvert national identity, culture, and religion, and promote this tension so then they can justify their police state and work on this international interest. So I don't think Theresa May believes literally anything she's saying
right,
at all.
Right.
I don't believe she believes any of it. I don't believe any of the leaders of the Western world believe what they say. Tomorrow they could have a completely different ideology. But it's kind of like, you know, once again with George Orwell, Eurasia has always been our enemy. Well, now we're going to change it. You know, it doesn't even matter. Without even thinking, they introduce this Orwellian doublethink when it comes to our politics. And that's why we need to stand on a firm foundation of tradition and identity, because when people see and are exposed to the insanity of the leftist agenda and how they don't really stand for anything, I think more and more people are awakening to our cause.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what's the extreme hatred here, really, that is going on against the native population is really unprecedented. I mean, as you said, Matt, Arabs, you know, many who are Muslims, but also other non-white, non-native groups within European nations and also in America, of course, are literally untouchables, pretty much. I mean, while they're going after the native population who are setting up any kind of opposition to this, let's just put this in the context of things like Rotherham, for example, and what happened there, and the fact that it took them 10 years to actually start even making a move on this, and this was only after it's been exposed a number of times in the media. There was another case now, a 13-year-old schoolgirl in Britain, I forget exactly where it was, she was repeatedly raped and passed around by a gang of 15, I don't know if they were Muslims, but they were Pakistanis or something like that. And this just keeps happening. And these people are not thoroughly prosecuted. They're not going after. They're actually going after the fathers in some cases that are trying to protect their daughters from this kind of stuff. It's unbelievable. I don't have words for it.
Yeah, and in Rotherham, I mean, Matthew made the comment that the left don't stand for anything, but they do stand for something. They stand for everything that's against what we believe in, and it's all by design and intentional. And what they did in Rotherham was they've broken down the British family. The left have obviously introduced no-fault laws for divorce. They've broken down the family. They've taken away the responsibility of parents. They tried to give the responsibility to the state. They've driven the father from the home, and they prevented him from coming back into the home when he's out the family. And so you have the situation where you have young girls, vulnerable, and then they bring in the foreigners, they bring in the Muslims, and then when they prey upon these young girls, they tell us that we can't criticize it because it's racism. So, you know, at the end of the day, you know, I really believe it's all been by design. You weaken the country, you weaken the family, you take the men out of the equation, and then you bring in these other men into the equation knowing they're going to harm these young girls. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to recognize that when you bring in young Muslim men who are not going to say, you know, anything to their own women on the streets, when they have a chance to sleep with young 13-year-old English girls who just give themselves away because they have no male figures in their lives, which have been taken away by the left, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to recognize that was probably the end game from the start.
Yeah, I know. Some of the most extreme Muslims are have their organization run out of London in some cases. There are Sharia courts in England too. I mean, I guess on the official level, they have them as kind of ceremonial. They're not kind of legally binding, I guess. But it's just a matter of time, right? It's just when these people. I saw this poster from the youth mayor of London or whatever. There wasn't a single native British person on there. There's hardly any white people left in London anymore. They're all taking off. This is territory now that's being handed off to all these other groups that are now starting to fight over the territory to make it theirs. They have ruthless ethnic interests, while of course we can have none, right?
Well, and that's actually where you look. You know, within the United States, Los Angeles, I think, is one of the best examples. The largest gang bust ever conducted by the federal government was actually on what was called the Hawaiian Gardens Gang, because there were gang wars between blacks and Hispanics, where a Hispanic gang actually declared it was going to ethnically cleanse the neighborhoods. I mean, the whites had already left decades before, but they were going to ethnically cleanse the neighborhoods of all blacks, and they were shooting little black girls who were just riding their bike. You know, it wasn't a gang thing. It was a racial conflict, and it was the largest gang bust in American history. It barely made the news, and everything carried on. And that was just, you know, one example of how when the native population is driven out and you bring in people from literally all around the world who still have all of their beefs that have some, in some cases, been going on for centuries or millennia back in their home countries, well, they're not just going to all get along. You know, we've seen examples of these migrants in England and other countries. They actually get into street battles with each other because one's an Indian, one's a Pakistani, one's an Afghani, and they all fight each other. So the idea, if only to keep a sane and civil society, the idea of taking all these people who have all these ethnic conflicts, all these different ethnic interests, and jamming them together in the same area, it's already proven itself in Europe and America that ethnic conflict is inevitable. It's just funny to me that the ethnic conflict generally isn't the native white populations resisting. It's these other groups that come in and just fight and literally kill one another.
Well, that's why, you emasculate the indigenous male and you castrate him and you teach him that, you know, what's important is, you know, getting into fights in the bar and watching football on the weekends and not defending his homeland and his families. So, you know, it's all intentional at the end of the day. They bring them in knowing the conflict will take place. I mean, it doesn't take much. I mean, when you bring in Shia and Sunni Muslims into the same refugee camp, it doesn't take much of an expert on Islam to know they're not going to get along with each other.
Well, you know, it's developing into the fact that we are to spend basically all our resources and time and means on somehow playing kind of referee and judge between these rivaling groups. We put up a show Wednesday where we highlighted this, of how Sweden is basically turning into a dangerous battleground for incompatible cultures, while we just kind of move to the sidelines of trying to, play the peacekeeper. At the same time, our young girls and women are getting raped on epidemic scale. And, of course, the feminists are not saying anything. They're not speaking up about this because it's ultimately against... It's an anti-white agenda, right? That's really what's at the bottom of this. Whatever leads to white genocide and removing white people, that's the agenda that they'll go for. That's the play they'll go for, right?
Well, it's like, you know, for instance, when I was working, when I just started nationalist politics and was not wise to the Zionist issue or things like that, I just saw more of a cultural struggle. And of course, I've evolved over time, but it kind of blew my mind, the idea that I wasn't even anti-Zionist at the time, but we were protesting a rather radical speaker that was brought in by the Muslim Student Association, and the Jewish group was picketing us, and the feminist group picketed us, and all these other groups picketed us in this unified coalition, which didn't make any sense. I actually asked the feminists, I said, what we're opposed to is people who believe in Sharia law in the West that would take away your ability even to be on this university. And they said, it doesn't matter, you're a fascist, and I hope you die. I thought we killed you all in 1945. All that sort of rhetoric. But there's this cognitive dissonance in their minds where feminists are feminists up to the point where they're attacking white men. But when it comes to Muslim men saying they want to have, you know, apparently the institution of marriage is the patriarchy and is horrible. But when radical Muslims in the West want four wives, want to be able to beat their wives, want to restrict them from even having driver's licenses or knowing how to read, well, that's multicultural. I mean, that's foreign. That's ethnic. That's a good thing. And they don't even think about it because they're, I mean, Jack said it, and you said it, Hendrik, the idea that the left is just conditioned to just hate white people, and especially white men who traditionally, of course, have been the protectors and providers for our nations, that they just hate us. And that's one thing the leftist coalition, which makes no sense on its face, all comes together. If you hate white Christian men, then you can be in the club. But if you're a white Christian man or, you know, any part of that, then you're on the other team, and that's what they want to destroy. It's us.
Yeah. Well, guys, let's play with that idea for a little bit, that let's say the white people, well, especially white males, were removed from the Western world as things are right now. What would happen? Well, I mean, we have kind of alluded to it a little bit already in terms of these rivaling groups, but the fact is, it would just turn into utter chaos, wouldn't it?
Oh yeah, I think they have a field day with the women, and it would be. I mean, look how they don't like the women in their own countries, and that's one of the reasons they come here. And you know, if they had their way, they would just do as they wish. I mean, female genital mutilation is something that's quite common in a lot of these countries. And when they come to Europe, they don't see a problem with it. And there's a lady in Italy named Cecile Kienge. I recall that she is the product of a family with like 55, 60 different children in it. And she actually fights for polygamy in Italy. So here's a woman from sub-Saharan Africa who lives in Italy, who's some kind of a minister for multiculturalism, who's fighting for the same sort of barbarity and lunacy that takes place in her country. So can you imagine if the men were the only ones left? I mean, I don't think there'd even be issues of trying to fight for changes of laws. They would just do it.
Well, what will it take, do you think, guys, before we not only can attain the same rights to protect our interests and our own people as some of the other groups are, but actually get to a position again where we have precedence over these things within our own countries because of the fact that we founded them? They are our countries. What will it take? Because obviously, if things deteriorate, we are going to get to a situation where people are going to start organized. Americans, Europeans within various countries, they're going to get to a point where they basically say, that's it, that we've had it. There's nothing left to lose. The situation is so dire that we have to try to do this on our own. And as soon as that happens, just as you pointed out, Matt, there will be tremendous pressure from the own governments to go after their own people that are trying to protect mm-hmm. themselves, basically. And they'll target them first. There can literally probably be a almost civil war, gang-type relations between some of these people, and they will obviously target the native population. But at some point, this will be so obvious that most people see what this really is about, and they will see that they're actually actively targeting the native population as opposed to protecting them. And then at that stage, then they would have gone too far, right? It's real possible that it's going to come to something like that, but that means that means sacrifice, right? That means that there have to be people who are willing to be there on the front lines to demonstrate that this is indeed the agenda of the elites that are the hostile elites that we have within our countries. Matt, thoughts?
Well, I think when it comes down to it, the left, I mean, Jewish power, always overreaches because they truly believe that we are stupid, that we're weak, that we won't stand up. But, you know, throughout history, we always stand up. When Europeans are backed into a corner, you know, we have a sensibility of fair play, of justice, and, you know, also compassion. But when there comes a point, we always stand up. Historically, it's always happened. And I think one of the biggest steps we need to be taking now within our movement is we need to be promoting European cooperation. You know, as an example of where European cooperation could have stopped the plans of the global elites, in the American South during desegregation, when the American president came in and sent federal troops at bayonet point to forcibly integrate schools, the South was united. But the South didn't reach out to white interests around the rest of America, because actually when then Martin Luther King, after the South had been fully desegregated, went into Chicago and said, housing developments can't have any rules, there can't be a community, that it doesn't matter about legal segregation, we just have to bust up white communities and be able to bring in all this Section 8 housing and stuff. And thousands of whites stood up, you know, in South Boston. Then when there was forced busing, where they were taking white kids and forcing them to go to black ghetto schools where girls were raped, where whites were beaten and victimized. It was horrible. But then whites in South Boston stood up. But the problem was they weren't united. There was no movement between the South and whites in the North and in the West who all wanted to just be able to be left alone, didn't want the federal government getting involved in our business, and didn't want our children to become the victims of anti-white violence. We didn't stand up together. And that's eventually why the states' rights movement, I think, failed. So as an example for us, you know, there could be an example, let's say tomorrow, Germany woke up. Every German woke up, said Germany for the Germans, and they were going to stand up. But all the other European countries surrounding them, the United States, would all jump on them, would all persecute them,
yeah,
and probably try and destroy them. So that's where it's so important. And again, this is why I think Jack and I working together, other nationalists working together here in America, between the Europeans, is so dangerous to the system, because we're promoting cooperation, we're promoting understanding, we're promoting having a unified front. And that's dangerous to the system, because eventually the left will push too far and people will react. But if they react in an emotional way, and there's no leadership, there's no plan, then things will end up falling apart, and they can be easily picked off and defeated one country at a time, one movement at a time. So victory is going to come, in my opinion, when we can all put aside any differences we might have, and Europeans view ourselves as one extended family and work and fight together. If we can come together, we can defeat the enemy. If we remain divided over petty differences, the system can pick us off. But
yes.
We can't be defeated.
It's incredibly vital what you say, Matt, and I absolutely agree with you. I think there is a we're kind of at that point right now too, because obviously the rhetoric by our opposition and everything else has been so ramped up in the last few years that more and more people are coming over to our side. They're seeing what we're saying. They're seeing that what we've been talking about is the reality.
The only problem with that, though, is, as you notice, as our movement gets stronger, we get infiltrated.
This is my point. Yeah.
This is the big problem.
Yeah.
That I see, that they will infiltrate and they will take over once they recognize that we become a formidable force. And there's, even when I look at the parties I've been involved in, you can only go so far because they've been totally infiltrated. And even organizations that have not been infiltrated, in order to get funding, they pander to groups that will basically grease their pockets, and so they won't cross that line. And at the end of the day, we haven't really accomplished anything. You know, UKIP looked wonderful, but it would never accomplish anything because they pander to the same groups as the left controlling the left.
Well, and that's actually why, Jack, one of the things that I see as a big hope for us, you look historically, the far-left movements both in Europe and America got the majority of their funding from the Soviet Union, got support from the communist Chinese and things like that. There was the idea of this international axis of communists of the far left all working with one another. Mm-hmm. And I think if we can be able to promote cooperation and solidarity, there is the potential. You know, I don't think Vladimir Putin is riding in on a white horse to save the day for everybody. Obviously, I think he has his own geopolitical interests. But right now where we stand, supporting nationalism, stands against NATO going into Eastern Europe, stands against military intervention within the Middle East. So there's a potential, I think, that we might find allies where Americans, those in the Anglosphere, and Western Europeans might find perhaps within the Russians, the Iranians, and countries around the world that are realizing what a threat globalism is to them, that there could be that level of support. Because if we're working is this international coalition. You know, I think there's a good example earlier this year in St. Petersburg where there was a meeting held where they had dozens of political parties from all around the world come together to discuss nationalism and fighting against globalism on this unified front. If we can promote this unified front, we won't have to pander to you know, within European politics, be able to get money and support. But if we all help one another, I think we can be able to move forward. This traditionalist internationale, I think, could inevitably be victorious because we can't do it on our own. We have to treat this as an extended family going to war together, you know, just like the old Scottish tribes. You know, all the men would go off to war together, when the fire was lit. And the fire's been lit, so it's time for all the Europeans and all nationalists to fight together.
Absolutely, yeah. But there's historical precedents for this when, the Danes and the Norse people joined up with, I think it was Charlemagne, right? Ogier the Dane ended up helping them in some of their battles and whatnot. It's something like that has to be recognized. We realize that there is a bigger enemy, something we have in common. And I think that, Europeans can travel freely now within the Schengen area, basically the larger European Union. And there has to be a mobilization there that people are ready to go to an area where they are ready to help, even in America in some cases. Not everyone can just jump on a plane immediately, of course. In Europe you can drive, but nonetheless, it's about the willpower and it's about our ability to want to try to help each other. Sweden is a good example of this. There's a lot of people now starting to, mock Sweden and saying, like, oh, you deserve it. They're, like, basically kicking that one, the one that's lying down, because it's like, I guess they see it as a sign of weakness or something. And my message to those people is, like, you're idiots. Like, help us. We need help. We need you to come to our aid and be there and support us. If we are in a situation where we can get back up on our feet again, you'd probably have people within our area that can go to your country if something similar happens and helps out in that country. You know, so it's there has to be a rethinking here of what we can do and achieve that. But it's difficult with those type of umbrella organizations, though, because you got to have some kind of organizational skill at the top. You have to have some kind of centralized ability to organize those kinds of groups or whatnot. So it's not something you can do just overnight. But the idea, at least, should be there and should start going into effect so people know where to go and what to do.
Agreed. And that's actually one thing, you know, where Jack mentioned infiltration. If you look within the American movement, it's pretty easy to see when the federal government tries to infiltrate and subvert nationalist movements, they're always promoting illegal activity. And that's the sort of thing where they can get quick convictions because your average beat cop is interested in being able to get something on his jacket, you know, in his folder, and then he can have a nice retirement and things like that. So we need to be able to keep a lookout. We need to stand strong on our convictions, and it's very easy to get upset. You know, these things are happening, the rapes that are happening, the jobs that are lost, just the future ahead of us. It's very easy to get angry and upset. But we need to be a law-abiding, peaceful movement. And that's the sort of thing that around the world we need to awaken normal people, because working within communities, helping those in need, that's how we win the support from normal folks, and we can go and become this massive movement. So that's one thing I think is really important, though, you know, to address Jack's concern, is I do believe the system will try and subvert us. But as long as we're being legal, as long as we're being professional, if the system then cracks down on us as we're being law-abiding, it just exposes how absolutely insane they are. You know, that's really been shown with the Golden Dawn case, where they arrested the leadership of Golden Dawn because one Golden Dawn member got into a bar fight with an anti-fascist rapper, and it went poorly for the anti-fascist rapper.
Right.
You know, and they said, well, Golden Dawn's in charge of this, you know, this huge criminal network, and of course, all the court proceedings, they refused to bring the trials forward, they, you know, refused to show any evidence, and the system, I really think, kind of delegitimized itself by persecuting a legal nationalist force that spends its time feeding Greeks, you know, walking old people to the ATM so they can get their pension money without being robbed by immigrants, that help youth understand their culture. You know, it's a peaceful, legal, political movement and a social movement, and the system, by cracking down on that, delegitimized itself. So likewise, for the rest of us, by following that model of legal political organizing and cooperation with one another and respect for one another, if they do crack down on us, it's just going to delegitimize them further.
Yeah, and that's right. That's why, you know, they, like, besides infiltration, they try to break our spirit by arresting and, in our case, you know, banning Matthew from coming to Great Britain. And that's why for Matthew and I, it's really important that we do meet and that we hold our event in another location, because, you know, we cannot let them tell the masses that this is what will happen to you if you try to come together. We will stop you, and you will then do what they've done, which is nothing. So we're going to take a stand here, and we're going to spend our own money to come together on foreign soil, and we're going to hold an event in spite of what Theresa May has done to us.
You know, there are obviously political parties that have people within it that are subversive, or they have, you know, self-interests, whatever, people that are in there to disrupt. It would be true for any movement or any kind of larger organization, I think. But largely, the most important thing is that it continues to move forward anyway, to kind of pick up what you said, Matt, that there might be problems within it, yes, but basically keeping our eye on the prize of what is it that needs to be done here and achieved, as opposed to letting it spiral into, well, on one hand, paranoia, I guess, of trying to think that everyone else around you is an infiltrator or something like that. But it's about being wise and being aware, basically, of your surrounding and see what people around you do, so that you can basically see if there's someone who is trying to follow that path that you mentioned, Matt, of basically enticing someone to do something which is stupid or something, so that can be made known. But I think it's important not to, you know, internally try to monitor it to such a degree that it becomes very that it loses its ability to keep its eye on the prize, basically. So I think there are ways to do that. There's ways to go about those kinds of things of not worrying too much about that. I mean, yes, talk about it if it's known and if you see it, but, you know, otherwise it would just spiral out of control, basically, and people would turn paranoid. I've seen this so many times in so many movements. And that's really what breaks it up from the inside. The people begin to infight, and then that's really what the agents all they need to do is to let the word be known that yes, we have people within this organization, for example. That would be enough to break it up in some cases, I think. So it's important to put that to the side and really focus on what's important, you know.
I agree, and that's actually where looking at the counterintelligence program the Federal Bureau of Investigation did on the Ku Klux Klan and other anti-segregation or anti-desegregationist groups during the 1960s and 70s. If you read the files that have been declassified, in many cases they didn't even have informants or anything going on in most of these groups because they were contained within local communities. You know, in small southern towns, guys grew up together. They were kind of turn on their friends and in some cases their family. So what would they do? Well, they would make anonymous phone calls. They would write letters to different groups saying, well, this person is an infiltrator and said this. And like you said, they wouldn't even have to go through the trouble of getting someone into a group to try and subvert it, where they would they would pander to paranoia. So that's where, you know, Christ himself said you can judge a tree by its fruits. And in many cases, if there's a guy who is a loose cannon, if he does not show our movement to be good, well, he does need to be in the movement, whether he's an infiltrator or not, if he's not abiding by our principles and our values. But, you know, we can't go down the rabbit hole of being paranoid all the time, because we'll spend all of our time chasing our tails while the system every year is bringing in millions of more third worlders, is advancing a radical leftist agenda in the media and on our campuses. We've got a lot of work to do, and we need to be conscious, we need to be security conscious, but we can't fall into to paranoia, because the system, by its own records, has shown itself. It worked extremely well in the 1960s and 70s to stop nationalist organization in the United States. It's just by promoting this cult of paranoia. So we need to be action-oriented, goal-oriented, and just keep working towards it. And anyone who, you know, in my mind, is on the same page, working towards the same thing, is professional, helping organize people, they're my comrades, and let's judge a tree by its fruits.
Yeah, well said. There's nothing wrong with organizing an intelligence group either. That really needs to be taken to the next level. But let's see what else we should cover here. Before what's next here then, Jack? Let's switch over to you for a moment. Are you guys going to move ahead with the event? Tell us a bit more about that. Where are you looking to get Matt invited to now to speak?
Well, yeah, we're going ahead with the event on the 29th on Merseyside. Jez Turner will be speaking. And we will have another American nationalist in Matt's organization speaking. But Matt and I are going to be going to be meeting overseas, where we're going to do a little short documentary, illustrating what's transpired and, you know, how we've gone through with it anyway, and how we're going to basically give the middle finger to Theresa May and show that, you know, it's possible for people to get together, overcome, and our spirit will not be broken. And that's really what we're going to demonstrate in this video we made when we meet each other next week.
Matt, how long is this into effect? How long have you been barred from the UK?
Well, there actually is no appeal process, so I can't write a letter, I can't get a lawyer, anything like that. And they said they review the cases every 3 to 5 years, but of course I will not be allowed to represent myself or anything like that.
So it's indefinitely as far as you're concerned.
Yeah, I mean, for all intents and purposes, I expect to get a letter in 5 years to tell me I'm still banned. And this is just another tragic example of the Orwellian police state that is trying to clamp down on nationalists and free speech in England. But they won't stop us. I mean, we look at the example of, it's estimated between 50 and 100,000 Polish nationalists marched just a few days ago all around the European world, and even here in America. People are waking up. People are organizing. They're getting in the streets. They're getting active. We're putting out more videos, more podcasts, more articles, more books, more street demos, more everything. So our movement is rising. So I imagine, hopefully, before I die, hopefully of old age, God willing, when nationalism has risen in Britain and an English government that represents the interests of the English people is once again in power of the United Kingdom, I hope to be able to take that letter that Theresa May wrote me, show it to them, and be welcomed into the land of my ancestors.
Well, exactly. Did you have you been to England before? Were you regular there?
I've actually never been to England.
Oh, okay. There you go.
So I'm so dangerous. I didn't even ever get to step foot on British soil or have a single order of fish and chips. I was really let down.
It's utterly, just hypocritical it's totalitarian. It's unbelievable that this is starting to happen. It's really an exclusion based on, opinions and thoughts, which is deviating from the, it's beyond political correctness at this point. It's just simply totalitarian. So, but I think it's good at this. I know it's painful for us. It's difficult for, you, Matt, to a certain extent, to be in that position. You have been limited in terms of what you can do. But at the same time, we have to use that as an opportunity to show everyone else their true colors. You haven't done anything wrong here. You're not enticing people to go out and murder somebody or kill somebody or any kind of violence or anything like that. You have deviating opinions, basically, and they are absolutely not going to tolerate you from voicing your opinions. And it's kind of a classic example of them basically being unable to deal with the facts that you present, and instead, like a child, trying to gag you and basically saying, no, nope, you're not even allowed to speak because we're not going to deal with the points that you bring up, right?
Exactly. And that's actually the sort of thing that, you know, it's funny. They think by stopping me, they can even, you know, of course they're not going to be able to stop nationalism, but they can't even stop the Traditionalist Worker Party. You know, we've got multiple members that are actually going on a delegation to visit with European nationalists, and one of them, as Jack had said, is going to be a speaker at the event I was banned from. So I'm going to record a little speech to give to them, to give, you know, my greetings to everyone, thank God, due to technology. We're all only one Skype call away from sharing our ideas with our comrades, but one of the members of our group is going to be speaking at that event. So, you know, what they did is they exposed themselves. They showed that they don't support free speech, but at the end of the day, unless they're going to ban every American from coming to England, we're going to get somebody in who's going to be able to network with our brothers and sisters in the English nationalist movement. So they can keep trying. They can ban a lot of comrades before we run out. So
yeah, exactly. I think they're overplaying their hand a little bit, especially if they keep up with this in this kind of capacity. So it's as difficult it is. So I kind of welcome it, you know, because they're really putting their foot in their mouth, you know?
I look at it this way. I mean, if Matthew came to speak with us, we probably would have had maybe 5,000 to 10,000 people watch the video we put on YouTube. Well, because they banned Matthew from coming, we're talking about probably hundreds of thousands of European nationalists. We'll see this. When I say nationalists, I mean patriots in Europe, in the United States. They'll learn about this through Red Ice, through RT, which did a story on it, even through the left-wing press like The Mirror and The Guardian, who've done stories on it. People will then watch what we make in terms of the documentary that we put on YouTube. So at the end of the day, I'm sure we will get six-figure notoriety from this. When if they had just let Matthew come in and speak, we probably would have had maybe 3,000 to 4,000 hits on the video. So at the end of the day, they've helped us. So thank you, Theresa May.
I'll have to send her a Christmas card.
Exactly. Yeah, show our good opinion.
Hanukkah card.
or Ramadan card, you know. We'll have a multicultural experiment there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, never.
She did say publicly that without Britain, without Jews, Britain wouldn't be Britain, and I find that quite remarkable. Yeah, and that's something she's been quoted saying on many occasions.
Well, thank God for, you know, London Shumrim, so they can keep everyone safe over there, you know. So.
Yeah.
Oh my God! Yeah, it's funny, you know. It's good times, you know. I think keep our spirits high despite this, and there are a lot of good things that is going to come out of something like this. So absolutely, you're both right. Let's see if there's anything else we should wrap up on here before we start. Wrapping up, I guess for this time. Matt, give us some of the details about your stuff, of course, where people can find more of your work, the organizations you're involved in. Give us the details on that.
Sure. Well, most folks know me from the Traditionalist Youth Network, and our website is tradyouth.org. It's where we maintain a very active blog, podcasts, and videos. But folks should also go take a look at, we've started this new political endeavor, the Traditionalist Worker Party, and that website is tradworker.org, so tradworker.org, where they can find out about how, if you're in America, you can get involved with our party. We're going to be running several candidates on the local and state level in 2016, actually possibly working on a recall of some of the members of a town council in Kentucky. So that could be an exciting potential. And we're also going to be participating in events throughout December, like Christmas parades and small town charity events. So if you're action-oriented, if you want to run as a candidate, you want to organize charity events to be able to actually help white people, you know, if we're white nationalists, you know, ethnic advocates, we need to start taking care of our communities because the system, as we've proven, sure as heck won't. So check us out on tradworker.org. You can go ahead and get in contact with us. And also, anyone who can follow me on Twitter, it's twitter.com / Matthew Heimbach, pretty easy to find. You can reach me through there. And, you know, if you're an American nationalist, let's work together, because like I always believe no enemies to the right, and it's time for us to really scare the system by working together.
Very good. Jack, tell us about British Renaissance.
Well, I'm doing the British Renaissance. The website is www.britishrenaissance.org. We're going to push ahead with the event on the 29th and hopefully have several more in the new year and then in the springtime. I hope to have something similar to what, you know, you see in the United States with AMREN and the National Policy Institute, just maybe with a bit more of an aware message. And then we have the publication that's coming out. It's a collection of nationalist essays written by, well, myself. Nick Griffin's written an article, Jez Turner's written a few articles, Andrew Bronze, former member of European Parliament, Andrew Anglin's in there, Dan Root, It's called How to Get Suspended from Your Parliamentary Election in 10 Articles and 2 Tweets, which is what I did. And then we actually just added How to Get Suspended from UKIP and the BNP in 10 Articles and 2 Tweets.
Ah.
So we're pushing the publication, which will be, I think I'll probably advertise it on the British Renaissance website as well as possibly European Knights Project. I also write a column for the Occidental Observer. In general, just pushing forward with the message and doing our best to bring people together in the United Kingdom and internationally. Hopefully, in the future, we can do more events. Hopefully, one with Matthew in the future, where he can come back to Britain. We might need to get a new prime minister, a new party in charge of the country, but it'd be nice to have Matthew come into the country at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll have the links up that you guys mentioned. Thank you again for joining us on such short notice, gentlemen. Keep up the good work. Always great connecting with you. I hope we can speak soon again.
Thank you so much, sir. Have a good day.
Thanks, Henrik. Great program. Thank you very much.
That's our one segment show for today. Thank you for listening. We're always glad that you want to spend some of your time with us and informing yourself. If you like what we do and want to get access to the second hour of most of our shows, videos, inside episodes, and much more, please sign up at redicemembers.com. Help to keep us ad-free. Support independent radio that brings you the counter to the narrative of the establishment and that which enables the politicians and their policies to be implemented in the West against the will of most people. Sam Dixon, Gavin Kilgore, Jenny Upton, Pete Papaheraklis, and Victor Thorne, and also James Fetzer are some of our upcoming guests. You can see the full list in our radio archive. Well, have a great weekend wherever you are, and we will speak more soon. Take care.